The Congress of the United States was the subject of a wide-ranging conversation we recorded with David B. Truman, Professor of Government and Dean of Columbia College at Columbia University in New York City. Professor Truman is the author of two seminal volumes on American government, The Governmental Process and The Congressional Party. A recent president of the American Political Science Association, he is a distinguished student of our national legislature. As we spoke, Professor Truman commented on the composition of the Congress, its essential functions, and its role in American life today. We began by asking Professor Truman, quite simply, what is the Congress?
The response to the question, what is the Congress, really is, it's at least two things. It is a Senate and a House. And in the process of our being aware of the conflicts between the president and this two-headed Congress, we often lose sight of the fact that there is conflict between the two parts of the Congress, at least those two parts. There's some others, too. These two bodies are, as bodies and as individuals, jealous of each other. And it's symbolized in little things, such as the reference to them always as the other House. And the House of Representatives member does not like to have the House referred to as the lower House. This is not just a matter of rhetoric, and it's not just a matter of pride or sensitivity. There's some good, solid, hard reasons for this. A member of the House of Representatives from a given state is always potentially a rival to the senator, and vice versa. A senator can influence the fortunes of the member of the House politically, and the very popular member of the House of Representatives can be a candidate in the next primary against the sitting senator. So that there is inevitably tension between these two. There is a disadvantage to the House member in his being a part of a very large body, 435 men. The most shocking experience any new congressman gets is having been the kingpin in his constituency and elected with great fanfare. He arrives in Washington, he's absolutely nobody. He's a freshman member of the House of Representatives in the first place, and then he's just a member of this great amorphous body. You can see it when you go into the two chambers. You go into the Senate, and because there are only 100 of them, you can sit there and look at a little chart and identify who's sitting where. But in the House of Representatives, you know, maybe if he's presiding, that the speaker is in the chair. And if you know a little bit about it, you know that the manager of the bill under discussion is on the one side and his opponents are on the other. But the members of the House sit anywhere they want to in there. It's a fluid kind of body. The member of the House has to work awfully hard to get visible, to get into the national press, even sometimes to get into his local press. A senator can get on the airwaves, can get before television, can get attention at any time he wants. So there are all kinds of built-in hostilities that go down to matters of real political rivalry and often basic kind of policy questions that tend to pull these two bodies apart to a degree. And not totally, but they tend to pull them apart. And there are all kinds of symptoms of this that occur in ordinary session of the Congress, sometimes quite bitter. So that there are at least two bodies that are involved. In consequence of this, these are two very different kinds of bodies. The Senate is properly described as a club. It's possible to know everybody in the Senate. It's possible for an individual senator to get quite a lot done in the Senate, if only because he doesn't have to deal with as many people. He hasn't got as complex an organizing job if he has his own enterprise that he wants to get going. Whereas in the House, he's got a big, massive thing. He may be, if he wants to get something done, be able to work through the leadership to get it done. But as a relatively junior man, he's not likely to be able to accomplish that. A relatively junior senator can, in fact, get quite a lot done. This is one of the reasons why House members very characteristically aspire to the Senate. And I've talked to many who have moved from one to the other, and I say, what's the difference in your feeling about it? And the usual first answer is, you can get so much more done here. Now, that means that these are really very different kinds of organizations, and they feel differently about themselves, so that there is a kind of tension, a kind of pull between the two pieces. And dealing with the Senate is, from the point of view of the outsider, the president, for example, is a different kettle of fish from dealing with the House of Representatives. A senator almost inevitably feels himself to be, in a sense, a kind of ambassador from his state. After all, he's one of the two top men, along with the governor, and governors are somewhat in eclipse these days. He's a name to be reckoned with. He's a personality. How many personalities do you know in the House of Representatives? Maybe a few, but I'll bet you could name 24 senators whom you could somehow have a vision of. You would recognize their pictures, you would recognize their names, you would associate some action, some position with them, and so on. These are very different kinds of things, and this means that a president dealing with the Senate has to recognize that he's dealing with, in a sense, almost a set of prima donnas, whereas with the House, he's dealing with more nearly a mass organization. So this is the basic reason why you say it isn't the Congress. There is a Senate and a House, and they are not just sort of equal partners in every respect of the same enterprise.
Given the fact that there are two houses of Congress, separate and distinct from one another, making different demands upon their members, offering them different responsibilities and opportunities, we asked Professor Truman whether there is, in fact, a typical congressman, a type of man particularly suited to serving in either legislative chamber.
In a certain sense, there is a congressman, even though there is a senator and a representative. And a congressman is a man who understands what the legislative game is. Perhaps I shouldn't say game, because it sounds as if I were being condescending or flippant about it, and I don't feel that way, because I think it's important, and I have myself profound respect for the members, on the average, of both the House and the Senate. These are as able Americans as you would find anywhere in any walk of American life. I don't care whether it's universities or in industry or in the newspaper world or wherever it may be. These are as fine men on the average as you'll ever find, as able, as dedicated, and as intelligent. So that maybe I shouldn't say legislative game, but if you understand that I mean it in a neutral way, I'll use it. He needs to understand how this is played, and it's not terribly different in the House from what it is in the Senate. It's different because of the scale, because of the difference in the organization, and so on. But there is a kind of negotiating, give and take, accommodating, but at the same time, deliberate quality about a good legislative man that is probably as clear a mark of the man, the good man in the House, as it is of the good man in the Senate. They have these things in common. They understand each other. In this way, they understand each other at both ends of the House. And they are men, many of whom operate most successfully on a kind of intuitive basis. And you know, if you want to get an explanation of politics, it's ordinarily not a good idea to ask a practicing politician, because he can't tell you what he does. If he's really good, he does it intuitively. And the way to learn what he does and why he does it is to watch him, not to ask him.
I do understand what you mean when you talk about the legislative game, but let me ask, what are the rules of the game in our Congress?
One of the rules is, believe it or not, compassion. You never, if you can help it, fail, at least privately, to recognize what the other fellow is up against. This is something that many outsiders find it difficult to understand. They will see two senators on the floor belaboring each other violently over an issue that they're debating, and then notice that they walk out into the cloakroom arm in arm, or they'll see them in a corridor in friendly conversation. This is not hypocrisy. This is not pulling the wool over the electorate's eyes. It's an awareness on the part of each that the other one is doing something for good reasons that he must do, and that they're both engaged in an enterprise that they have to carry on. There's a give and take, a compassion as part of it. Dick Russell, even in the heat of a filibuster on a civil rights action, is the kind of man who can understand why his opponent has to act the way he's acting. And frequently you get in the liberal a man who is so committed to a doctrine, so committed to a position, that in fact he's intolerant. And, well, it's a good idea to have some of those in any organization, and particularly in a legislative body, but if you have too many, you tear the place apart.
You think, then, that this compassion makes for a certain congressional tolerance, a willingness to allow criticism?
Voicing criticism, I suspect, is something that the other members of Congress, including the leadership, are likely to regard as something they mutually want to respect. And they're all members of Congress first, even the leadership, before they're anything else. There is a professional, normally a professional willingness to regard the other man's position as something that is entitled to be heard. Another one of the rules of the game is a willingness to do the work of the chamber, particularly the less conspicuous work. And it's as true in the House as it is in the Senate that there are those who are accepted by the great majority of those in either chamber because they're willing to do this, and there are others who are not. Particularly in the Senate, there are those who are known as outside senators and those who are known as inside senators. Although the outside senator often can have a certain kind of leverage, other things being equal, the man who is playing the game is going to have more influence in the House or in the Senate on behalf of his constituents or behalf of whatever causes he chooses to work with. Another rule that I should mention is the rule to specialize as much as you can. This is true in both Senate and the House. No member of the House or the Senate can be an expert on every piece of legislation that comes across the boards. And most of them can't even be fully expert on all the legislation that comes through their committees if they're on a major committee. So that a man is wise, if he wants to get ahead, to pick some area that is important in the Congress and probably, hopefully, important to his constituents, on which he becomes really expert. So that when he speaks, the others, particularly in his party, but maybe on either side of the aisle, will recognize that he speaks with some authority, with some knowledge, with some skill. And if he really is expert, they'll come to rely on him. So he carries a kind of obligation not to mislead them that goes along with it.
The rules of the game, as Professor Truman outlined them, set the pattern of behavior and help shape the formal procedures used within the Congress. But what of the relationships between members of Congress and those outside of Congress? In the conduct of congressional investigations, for instance. We asked Professor Truman about this sensitive and controversial area and about his own view of the importance of the congressional investigation.
The power of the Congress to investigate lies at the very heart of the Congress's most indispensable function, namely that of being critic and assessor. In a sense, it's the oldest legislative function that goes back long before our history. The great court of Parliament was an investigative body to a considerable extent. It is a power like all other powers that can easily be abused. And there is no question in my mind at all that over the years it has been abused, seriously. But as in all such situations, what you want to do is to correct the abuse and not throw away the power. Losing the baby with the bathwater is not good public policy. Excesses can come in if there aren't appropriate restraints placed on it. The abuse of personal privacy, the tendency for committees sometimes to, in effect, punish by the process of investigation, of which we've seen many instances, the tendency, therefore, in effect, almost to arrogate to itself the powers of the judiciary as well as the legislature, to destroy individual lives irresponsibly. This kind of thing is the danger that's involved in the investigative power. And to fine a man to put him into prison is no more severe, and I would say, in many respects, less severe than destroying his reputation by charges that are made in a non-judicial setting before a congressional committee. The investigation, so long as it can be focused on a general problem, in other words, as long as it relates somehow to the correction of administrative improprieties or toward displaying the necessity for a new kind of public policy of a legislative sort and so on, this is a very important thing.
As Professor Truman characterized the importance of the congressional power to investigate, he touched on the essential functions of a legislature. We asked him what these are, and in particular, what are the indispensable functions of the American Congress today?
A legislative body could be thought of as one which originates most policy, sets most policy, and supervises to, in certain ways, its execution. In that pure sense, there are probably no real legislative bodies at the national level in any major country today, and this trend is not going to be reversed. There's been a kind of conspiracy, inadvertent conspiracy, against legislative bodies in the 20th century generally. Their role, their function in the governmental system, whether it's ours or the British or the French or any other democracy, has rather subtly shifted in such a way that they don't seem to carry quite the importance that they once did. Or once were thought to carry. The principal thing is the change in the nature of the problems that government faces, both on the domestic side and in the United States and in the area of foreign policy. Because on the domestic side, you have developed a especially in the 20th century, a degree of industrialization and urbanization. These are all just big catchwords that, in fact, tend to cover up something profoundly important in the character of a society. Now, what this means is that, keeping it for the moment strictly on the domestic side, is that there has to be a kind of technical sensitivity, a technical expertness about keeping ahead of these things, or at least noticing them as they come up. There has to be the capacity to move rather quickly on them, if possible. All of which argues in the direction of the establishment or the strengthening of an executive side of things rather than a legislative side of things. Now, when you add to that, in the American case, the fact that we have, not just within this century, but within the past two decades, suddenly been really catapulted into a position of major world leadership, where not only does everything that happens here affect all parts of the globe, but where anything that happens anywhere in the globe affects us. Again, there are delicate matters of decision, of adjustment, of strategy, and so on, which are almost inevitably the responsibility of the executive, of the specialist, and not something that a parliamentary body can easily handle, because they aren't of that order. So these two kinds of things have tended to thrust the Congress into a relative different position, not absolute in a way, because in a sense you could say the Congress today in the mid-20th century is more important than it was in the 19th, simply because all government is more important. And if you want to measure it in dollars and cents, you can do it that way, because after all, the size of the federal budget is in a sense a measure of what Congress can do, and it debates things of great consequence. As one member of the House, now in a very prominent position, once said to me when I was talking to him about this, he could remember in his own lifetime, and he's been in the Congress a good many years to be sure, but it's less than all the years of this century, he could remember when the Congress had spent more days debating an issue involving a few thousand dollars than it now spends debating a matter of several millions or billions of dollars. That the volume of work that the Congress does is greater than previous Congresses, but the relative position of the Congress to the executive is somewhat different from what it was in the 19th century. I think this ties into the matter of the essential functions of Congress, the most central and indispensable functions of Congress, which are as critic, as protester, if you will, as needler, in that a body which is capable to sense what the criticisms and demands and so on are within the country, in fact, to focus them on ongoing policy and ongoing problems in such a way as to be an effective avenue of protest, of evaluation, of criticism of what's going on, and then possibly of correction. This is the central function, and it's more important than whether Congress passes particular policies or sets particular policies or not, as long as it can criticize them and evaluate them on your behalf and mine. And this kind of function, whether one thinks of it as producing important correctives, which it often does, or functioning in a sense as a kind of safety valve, which it often does, both of these are very important in a representative system. So that one can think of a shift perhaps in the central functions that are associated with Congress without accepting any suggestion that the Congress should be dispensed with. It is absolutely essential, in my judgment. And I think this is something which a great many people don't realize. They don't realize how important it is. And they see a Congress, say, which may be doing a job with respect to its own agenda, which is largely set by the president, and think, well, what do we need them for? Well, they do need them there as an arena, as a source of criticism and of skepticism, of counter-suggestion, sometimes even to help the executive. We cannot get along without strong presidents. But if we have a president who tends to take it easy, who isn't terribly strong, it is still possible for the Congress to take enough independent initiative, perhaps to force his hand, or even to get things done in spite of him, although you can't live for very long in that way. So I say this is probably good, because we can't be absolutely certain that we're going to have the right kind of president as the years go by. You need alternative sources of initiative and power in any good operating system, and this is why it's good.
This changing, viable relationship between the Congress and the president is central to our constitutional system and has, in fact, played a key role in American history. We asked Professor Truman to elaborate.
There have always been periods in American history when strong, vigorous, popular presidents have in fact been able to make the Congress do more or less what they wanted them to do. This was true, say, at least as early as Thomas Jefferson. It was certainly true of an Andrew Jackson. It was clearly true of an Abraham Lincoln. It was less true from Lincoln on down through most of the rest of the 19th century than it has been to a strong degree in the 20th century. There have been ups and downs in this all along. But it was possible 100 years ago, because the nature of the problems that the government was confronting, for the Congress, in fact, to take over the lead to a considerable extent and set the policy, to make the president, in effect, a mere executive, as somebody who simply carried out the will of the legislative body. He was a clerk, chief clerk to the legislative body, in a way. This is no longer possible. One of the most curious things, I think, about the changes that have occurred, say, in just the last 25 years, is not only the willingness of the Congress to accept a president's legislative program, but a kind of resentment of a president who doesn't do it. At the turn of the century, say, a president who proposed a legislative program and sent bills up to the Congress to be introduced to carry out his program would have been denounced on the floor of both the House and the Senate. Now he is expected to do this. And as was true to a degree in the Eisenhower period, where there was some early reluctance on President Eisenhower's part to do this kind of thing, there was real criticism. Some of it was partisan, to be sure, but not entirely. The Congress needs someone to fix its agenda, not to tell it exactly what it will do, that is, how it will vote, but what it will be voting on. And it needs to be done because of the technicality of the questions that are necessarily facing the government. So they've accepted this because they found it useful for their own purposes. This isn't dependence on the president. The Congress cannot really effectively work unless a president does this. It is always possible that the Congress may, in some degree, approach doing these things that the legislature, in the technical sense, would be expected to do. And it probably will go on doing some of that kind of thing for a good while. Because there still are pieces of legislation occasionally that really have their origins from the congressional side rather than from the presidential side, though they're fewer and fewer. If you think of the thing historically, not too far back, you can see, for instance, a number of the major pieces of legislation in the New Deal, though they might not have been passed but for the presidential championship, had in fact long been aired and sponsored in the Congress. The Wagner Labor Relations Act, the Federal Deposit Insurance Act, which is in fact originally sponsored by a Republican, not by a Democrat. Late Arthur Vandenberg was the real father of Federal Deposit Insurance. Much of the housing legislation of the 40s, so on, had its initial bubbling up at that stage.